Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Danger Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week in the podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm going to get on. We'll talk about what I'm reading about. And this may or may not be the last podcast of 2020. The next time you may hear my voice is in 2021. And as I did last year, and I probably will next year, I am asking for your help one of two ways. Either one, send me an email about what you do and don't like, something that you would like to see changed or not changed for 2021. I'll see if I can incorporate that into next year's podcast. Maybe you want more podcasts. Maybe you want shorter podcasts. Maybe you want something completely different. Maybe you don't want me to ever talk about vitamin D again. I know, trust me, me either. But I don't know what it is. You tell me, AndrewBuilt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com, or you can reach out to me on Twitter, at AndrewBuilt, and I will almost always respond relatively quickly. So with that, without any further ado, please let me know what you would like to see in 2021, and let's kick this thing out off for maybe the last, time, without any hesitation, without any reservation. It is good to be back. All right, here we go. AndrewBuilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing, shall we? You see, it is often said, what you see is what you get, and that is no more clearly seen. And then in the first paper titled Nutritional Analysis of Foods and Beverages Depicted in Top-Grossing U.S. Movies from 1994 to 2018. In this JAMA Internal Medicine article, which looked at the nutritional quality of foods and beverages that were depicted in the top 250 grossing U.S. movies from 1994 to 2018, they looked to see what were the food and beverages that were put in these movies. These 250 movies that they looked at were really popular movies. In fact, they sold over 10 billion box office tickets in combinations. In combination of the 250 movies, they grossed over $164 billion just in the theaters worldwide. These are really popular movies that I'm sure we have all heard of, but what they put on the movie screen becomes the societal norm, if you will. What you see is what you get, as I said at the beginning. So in this study, two trained researchers, which had to be maybe college students, because really, who has time to watch 250 movies? Two trained researchers viewed these movies in their entirety and listed all the foods and beverages depicted on the big screen. They then used the Nutrient Profile Index to classify the foods and beverages that were on the screen as either healthy or not healthy. The foods and beverages were penalized if they had high intakes of sugar, sodium, saturated fat, or total fat, but they were rewarded if they had high amounts of fiber, protein, fruits, and vegetables. Now, I understand that this is not a one-size-fits-all, and the authors openly and honestly admit that this was not portion-controlled, meaning that if there was a thimble of high fructose corn syrup soda that was on the counter, and then there was a whole garden of tomatoes, those were considered one-to-one. It wasn't controlled by, there was just a little bit of soda, but a whole bunch of healthy vegetables. No. It's a one-to-one. It just looked at the picture that was put on the screen. It looked at the individual scene, not the quantity of food in that individual scene. The results showed that the nutritional ratings were terrible. In fact, about 73% of the movies received a less healthy food nutrition score, and 90% received a less healthy beverage nutrition score. But did it get better with time? I mean, after all, people used to smoke, so maybe back in 1994 it was really bad, and then as we become more aware in 2018, we're having healthier foods put onto the big screen. But the authors say, and I quote, "We found no evidence." Yes, there were no evidence of improvement over time in sugar, saturated fat, total fat, or sodium content of foods or in sugar content of beverages. There was no improvement over time. Part of the reason I bring up this article is because there are many disturbing findings in this paper. First of all, the G-rated movies, about 20% of the beverages in G-rated movies were alcoholic beverages. And if you looked at rated R movies, 50% of the time it was an alcoholic beverage. Oof. What about beverages' sugar content? Well, you will find that the sugar content was higher in movies that targeted younger individuals. That's not what we need. How high, you ask? Well, about 121 grams of total sugar per 2,000 calories, kilocalories. That equals three cans of Coca-Cola. Three cans of Coca-Cola per 2,000 kilocalories. That is too much. That's just way too much. And it shouldn't be put on the screen as, oh, look at this. This is completely normal. Well, I guess in summary, what you see is what you get. And if you see your favorite actor eating junk food in what makes a blockbuster hit, if you see your favorite actress having a high sugar three Coca-Colas in a row, well, then you're more likely to think that that is an A-OK thing. We already live in an obese society, and an opportunity where we can prevent or promote healthy eating should be done at every single turn. Even if that means during a movie while you stuff your face with 120 ounces of Coke and 600 and 20 ounces of buttery refill popcorn. But speaking of movies, what do you think? What do you think of Tom Cruise? Or maybe I should say, what do you think when someone says the movie Jerry Maguire? What do you think of with Jerry Maguire? I'll give you 2 seconds to think about it.
3, 2, 1.
The correct answer, or at least my answer, is show me the money. And if that is not what goes into your head, well then I don't know what to tell you, because that is a perfect segue into this next paper in Annals of Internal Medicine titled, Are Financial Payments from the Pharmaceutical Industries Associated with Physician Prescribing, a Systematic Review? This was a systematic review to look to see if payments from a drug industry is associated with physician prescribing practices. The results were completely obvious. If you got money, then you prescribed the drug company's drug more often. And this was also associated with increased prescribing cost. The total cost and rates of prescribing varied, but none, I repeat, none of the identified studies had all null findings. The easy answer is receiving payments from a drug company may lead a physician to prescribe more of that company's drug in the future. Or you can sit back and question medicine and look at it from a different perspective, such as the actual prescribing causes the payments. Drug companies target their payments to physicians who are already high prescribers of their drugs. Now, both mechanisms are completely plausible. Lucky for us, in this systematic review, the studies that looked at a temporal prescribing found substantial increases in prescribing immediately after receiving of each industry payment. Industry spending on drug promotion disproportionately targets drugs that are less effective or offer little therapeutic advancement because physicians want to use effective drugs, regardless of the promotion, whereas the marginal or minimal or barely not at all even kinda effective drugs require more intensive promotion to increase prescribing. An aspirin after a stroke, we know it works. We don't need to sell it to anyone. We don't need drug reps for it. Statins after MI, we know it works. We don't need anyone to come tell you if your patient has a myocardial infarction, you need to give them a statin. It's a no-brainer. Metformin for type 2 diabetes, once again, we know it works, and we don't need drug reps to come and tell us or try to convince us on some mechanism that may or may not benefit some surrogate end marker that we don't really care about, because we care about the hard outcomes. And the drugs that we do know about, we already know about them. They're tried and true. They're proven and real. We don't need drug reps for them. There is no need to show up at my door to tell me about some old drug that has been around forever, like aspirin. I think the pharmaceutical industry is the necessary evil. We need them. We do need them. They do great things, and they have the money to do fantastic trials because they have the money to chase people down to get the outcome data we need. But taking money from the drug companies tugs on our heartstrings. It tugs on our need as prescribers to prescribe their medications, even when our patients may benefit from another or different or cheaper drug. And if you think, well, Andrew, this doesn't apply to me, I know that other people are persuaded by the drug company money, but that doesn't apply to me, I want to repeat what I said earlier. None of the identified studies had null findings. So unless you think you are magically different than every other provider that has ever been studied, then yes, even you are affected by drug company money. The money, the meals, the pens, money talks. All must realize that us, any of us, taking money is persuading how we practice medicine. On to the next article. And the next article is titled Association Between High Temperatures in Pregnancy and Risk of Preterm Birth, Low Birth Weight, and Stillbirth, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. In this systematic review and meta-analysis, it found a small but very real and pretty consistent association between exposure to high environmental temperatures and pregnancy outcomes. The odds of a preterm birth rose by 5% per 1 degree Celsius, and by 16% during heat waves, which were defined as two or more days with temperatures above a predefined threshold. Now, this was a systematic review and meta-analysis, so each study had their own different predefined threshold. The point of the matter is, the more heat, the more you needed to get out of the kitchen. This gives me two pieces of information, which is those individuals who work out a lot should probably avoid the hot yoga sessions during pregnancy and stick to just regular yoga for the 9 months. And those individuals with low economic status and no access to air conditioning will suffer. And on a grand scale, we'll see higher rates of preterm delivery in this patient population. This is sad. And if a real finding, this is one we will never see on a microscopic data level. We'll never ever with our own eyes be able to detect a 5% increase in preterm deliveries. I mean, after all, the 95% confidence interval went down to only a 3% increase. We are just not that good as humans to detect this very small difference. But on a larger macroscopic scale with big data, it then becomes much clearer. I am eager for more information on this in the future, but it saddens me that I'm not sure what we can do with it. It's certainly a situation in which those that are economically disadvantaged will seem to suffer. And with that, let's move on to another topic in women's health. Do you remember last year? Yes, last year when I said, according to me, and now according to ACOG, for almost 10 plus years, we should let women get birth control over the counter. It was one of the articles I thought was the top article of 2019. And when I told you this during that podcast, I told you I thought it was absolutely insane that patients had to come to providers to get birth control, that we are not so special that they need to come to us to get contraception. Well, we are one step closer to making it so they don't have to. This was in The Lancet. It was a paper titled Use of Effective Contraception Following Provision of Progesterone-Only Pill for Women Presenting to Community Pharmacies for Emergency Contraception, a Pragmatic Cluster Randomized Crossover Trial. Woo! This was a pragmatic cluster randomized crossover trial of almost 600 women receiving emergency contraception in a pharmacy, and they were randomized to either receive an intervention group or the control group. And in the intervention group, the women received a 3-month supply of the progesterone only pill plus rapid access card to a participating sexual and reproductive health clinics. In the control group, the pharmacists advised women to attend their usual contraception provider. The primary outcome was use of contraception or effective contraception at 4 months. Although there was a significant amount of individuals lost to follow-up, almost 40%, which was higher than the expected 25% lost to follow-up, The authors, at 4 months, found that the proportion of women that were using effective contraception was 20% greater in the intervention group than in the control group. So basically, you had a whole bunch of women coming in for Plan B or emergency contraception, and then the women that were given birth control, they were given 3 months of birth control and said, here's a card, go follow up with this doctor and you can get more birth control. These women were then found to have 20% greater rates of using birth control four months later. This makes total sense. If a woman is coming in for Plan B, she's clearly already having sex. She's clearly already saying, ooh, I'm having sex, I'm having a kind of a scare here, and I'm not on birth control, which is probably why she's coming in for the Plan B to begin with. So if we just give them Plan B at that time frame, this is a perfect time to intervene. It's a perfect time to intervene. And it looks like it worked. But taking birth control or being on birth control is a surrogate outcome. So let's look at the secondary outcomes. We don't necessarily care if you take birth control. We care about if you get pregnant. Well, the secondary outcomes were incidence of abortion in the 12 months following recruitment and economic evaluation of the intervention. Sadly, this study would have needed about 2,000 patients to clearly tell a difference in the unexpected pregnancy or abortion rate. I guess the summary is that if you want women to be on birth control, you just have to make it easier for them. You have to make easy access. Whatever format that is fine with me. But let them have access to it. And if that means when they're coming in for Plan B, you give them access and you give them birth control, then I'm A-okay with it. Their risk of children far exceeds your need for another easy RVU patient. On to the next article. Which is a really breathtaking article and probably the last article of this podcast. It is titled, Managing Asthma in Adolescents in 2020, Asthma Guideline Update from the National Asthma Education and Prevention Program. Oh yes, oh yes, it is a guideline update on asthma. Here is the important thing to know about asthma update. That is that those with mild persistent asthma should use either regular daily inhaled corticosteroid with an as-needed SABA, albuterol, or use both inhaled corticosteroid and SABA on an as-needed basis. Those with moderate persistent asthma should use inhaled corticosteroid and formoterol daily with additional doses of ICS formoterol as needed. Some of you will say, this is different than the GINA or GINA guidelines that I heard you mention last year. This is not the same recommendation that you said with the GINA or GINA guidelines that you said last year, because if you recall back, you'll remember that with the GINA or GINA guidelines, it was ICS formoterol, and the only thing that you can get ICS formoterol in the United States is budesonide formoterol, right? From the start, they said, just go ahead and give them budesonide formoterol. Where here in this guideline, they're saying, when it's mild to persistent, we should do daily ICS with as-needed SABA or do both ICS and SABA at the exact as-needed basis. And then you move up to budesonide formoterol. It is truly 6-1 way, half a dozen the other. Yes, this guideline and the GINA guidelines are different. Yes, they are coming out with two different recommendations for mild persistent asthma. And you may be asking, well, what is the right answer? If one guideline says one thing and one guideline says the other thing, what is the right answer? And the correct answer is... the correct answer is not what you should do, because really it is probably 6-1 way, half a dozen the other. When you actually look at the data, it really is, for those low-risk, mild, persistent asthma people, it is probably 6-1 way, half a dozen the other. But the correct answer is what you should not be doing. You should not be doing PRN albuterol. When the patient comes in and they're freshly diagnosed asthma, you don't say, oh, here is PRN as needed albuterol. We're just going to start you on as needed albuterol. The newly diagnosed asthma patient really should no longer be on ever, never, ever, ever, ever gonna get it PRN albuterol. Those days are done. The data and the guidelines agree. And with that, let's wrap this thing up before this ship sets sail in a sea of evidence. Okay, a recap of the articles that I have talked about today. The first article that I talked about was food and beverages in movies, and there are way too many unhealthy foods and unhealthy drinks on the big screen. We need to be aware of this because this is not normal. We can't let other individuals, especially children, think that it is okay to have 54 ounces of Coke every day. That's just not an okay thing for us to do. And the next article was about money. Show me the money, Johnny. It is either that the industry pays physicians and then the physicians write for their drugs, or the physicians are already writing for the drugs and then the industry pays them because they're writing for the drug. It may be 6-1 way, it may be half a dozen the other, but realistically, if you take money, if you take a pen, if you take a steak, if you take anything from the drug company, then what you believe is completely twisted, is completely flawed. And there are way too many studies over and over and over again that prove this to be true. And no matter how good you think you are, you cannot overcome the bias that you will have once you take money from a drug company. I will tell you, I personally have not taken any money from a drug company since my graduation in residency. And I tried not to even my third year of residency, but there was this one time that I really needed a steak because I was super poor at the time. However, as an attending, not a dime, not a dollar, not a nothing. I refuse to take money from the drug company. And I think we should all do the same. We just can't control our own individual bias. And if you think you can, well, then that's your own bias talking about you trying to control your bias. And heat is bad. Heat is bad for the unborn baby. Unfortunately, those in the poor or disadvantaged low economic status are not going to be able to fight heat waves in really hot states. We're never going to be able to find this or see this observational data on a microscopic scale, but when you bring all the data together, it then looks like the signal is loud and clear. Heat is bad for the unborn baby and leads to low birth weights and increase in preterm deliveries. Luckily for us, though, unborn deliveries or unwanted deliveries should be lower. It should be lower if we, as providers everywhere, can push for over-the-counter birth control. We are not so important that people being women, need to come to us. In a paper which women who were randomized going for emergency contraception, aka Plan B, they were then either randomized to start on birth control or not start on birth control, handed to them by the pharmacist. And it was found that if you were randomized to start on birth control right then and there, well, 4 months later, you were 20% more likely to still be on birth control. This is a really good thing and something that we should try to push for all patients, all women, all everyone, everywhere. Birth control is good and having access to it is even better. And last but not least, there are new guidelines, new recommendations out on asthma. What do you do? The new guidelines from the National Asthma Educational and Preventional Program say for mild and persistent asthma, they recommend either regular daily ICS with as-needed albuterol or both on an as-needed basis, ICS and albuterol. This is different than previous GINA guidelines, which said right from the beginning, persistent asthma needs budesonide-famotidrol. What's the right question? The right question is no longer should we be writing for PRN albuterol in any individual, even if they have mild persistent asthma. And with that, I'll wrap this up as I've ended every one before it. Wait for the music. And until next time, keep quest and questioning.